headlines, Russia and Ukraine are holding a new round of face-to-face negotiations in Turkey in a bid to end the 34-day conflict. Pakistani opposition supporters rally in Islamabad as parliament prepares for a no-confidence vote against embattled Prime Minister Imran Khan. Also ahead, Iran welcomes a three-day ceasefire announced by Yemen's Supreme Political Council as an initiative to end the Saudi-led war and blockade. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. A fresh attempt at diplomacy is underway between Russia and Ukraine in the Turkish city of Istanbul as the conflict rages on. The face-to-face talks between negotiators from the warring sides is an effort towards ending the month-long military confrontation. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan addressed the delegates, saying the talks would pave the way for a meeting of the two countries' leaders. He also called for an immediate ceasefire. Russia and Ukraine held their first high-level talks in Turkey's Antalya on March 10th, but failed to reach a consensus. After that, they've held regular talks via video conference, but with no major breakthrough. The Kremlin spokesman says Russia will only resort to nuclear weapons if its very existence is threatened.
But any outcome of the operation, of course, is not a reason for usage of a nuclear weapon. We have a security concept that very clearly states that only when there is a threat for existence of the state in our country, we can use and we will actually use nuclear weapons.
Dmitry Peskov said not any scenario in the conflict with Ukraine will be the grounds for using a nuclear weapon. President Vladimir Putin last month ordered Russia's nuclear forces to be on high alert. The country has approximately 6,000 nuclear warheads, the largest stockpile in the world. Peskov also said Russia is convinced that NATO is a machine of confrontation and not cooperation and security. He noted that Moscow does not accept the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. The tribunal has opened an investigation into possible war crimes in Ukraine, but its prosecutor says Russia has not responded to his request for contributions. We've spoken to political commentator Scott Bennett to get his opinion. He believes the odds of Russia using nuclear weapons are very low.
Well, I don't think there's any chance of Russia using nuclear weapons in an offensive capacity. It is making the declaration that it will not tolerate any attacks upon it, be it in the form of conventional weapons, nuclear weapons, or, as we've recently discovered, biological and chemical weapons. So I think Russia is recognizing that it is doubling down on its economic war against NATO and the United States for its declarations of war by demanding oil be produced in rubles and sold on that monetary system. Of course, this is being challenged by Europe. So this is a Russian positioning itself for defense, but I don't think there's any real danger. There is almost a laughable hypocrisy in NATO and the United Nations and the World Criminal Court trying to charge Russia with war crimes, because as we're seeing every day, the evidence of war crimes is coming out that the Biden administration and members of the United States government have been involved in funding war crimes in the form of biological and chemical weapons.
The UN chief says the solution to the Russia-Ukraine conflict is political and not humanitarian, adding that the global body is seeking a ceasefire between the two neighbors. Antonio Guterres hoped that the UN humanitarian chief would travel to both Moscow and Kiev as soon as possible to explore the grounds for humanitarian ceasefire. Over a month of Russian attacks on Ukraine has taken a heavy toll on civilian lives and infrastructure. Ukrainian officials say almost 5,000 people have been killed in the southern city of Mariupol alone since Russian forces laid siege on the city. Kiev says the war has so far costed close to $565 billion in terms of damage to infrastructure, lost economic growth, and other factors. Ukraine's officials also say that they have proof that Russian forces have used banned cluster bombs in two southern regions of Odessa and Kherson. Moscow has already denied these allegations. Our correspondent Johnny Miller was in Ukraine last week to cover the conflict with Russia, but he cut his trip short and is now in the Hungarian capital, Budapest. He says the security situation inside Ukraine is too dangerous for journalists critical of the government and the NATO alliance.
I recognize that the security situation inside Ukraine was too dangerous for certain journalists. A few days ago, the Ukrainian government banned most opposition parties in the country. They banned most media in the country, except for their one central channel and some foreign reporters. But in Ukraine right now, there's a feeling of anybody who reports in any way against or critical of the Ukrainian government or critical of NATO, then they can be seriously under threat. My own position on the conflict, I'm against Russia's invasion, but also very critical of NATO's involvement, of their pushing into the east, of them sending arms to Ukraine. Also have some criticism of certain elements within the Ukrainian army, Azov battalion and the ultranationalists and the Nazis, an openly neo-Nazi battalion within the Ukrainian army who are doing some of the major fighting on the east. If you're inside Ukraine and you want to cover that story or criticize those kind of stories, then you're under serious threat. And indeed, even if you voice the opinion that in some way NATO can be in part blamed for this crisis, indeed, even if you espouse the view that is being commonly understood now that Ukraine is largely a proxy war between Russia and NATO, and that Ukraine and the Ukrainian people are being very much held hostage to this proxy war, even if you espouse that very mild opinion, that's against Ukrainian army. Certainly certain elements of the European anti-war left, like Noam Chomsky and other figures, have been documenting how NATO has been pushing into the east for many years, and Ukraine is being funded by NATO. And some people argue that NATO has in some way provoked this war by pushing NATO further and arming troops, arming the Ukrainian army. In the West, if you voice that opinion, you're told that you're a Putin apologist. Inside Ukraine, whether you're a foreigner or Ukrainian, if you voice that opinion, frankly, you could be in danger of your life.
Moving on, supporters of opposition political parties in Pakistan have staged a rally against Prime Minister Imran Khan in the capital, Islamabad. The rally came hours after the parliament took up a no-confidence motion pushed by opposition lawmakers to remove Khan from power. The House will begin a debate on the motion on Thursday, and a vote will be held within 7 days. Khan lost the parliamentary majority with a series of deflections from his Tehreek-e-Insaf party, leaving him reliant on coalition allies to stay in power. Khan's opponents believe they have enough votes to unseat him. Pakistan is currently grappling with soaring inflation and unemployment, with accusations of corruption and mismanagement plaguing the government. Khan says a foreign-funded plot is underway to topple him. Our correspondent Kamran Yusuf says the demonstrations against Imran Khan are part of the political turmoil in Pakistan.
As far as rallies are concerned, this is, of course, part of the overall political tension that is brewing in Pakistan since opposition moved a no-confidence motion. We saw a couple of days back, Prime Minister Imran Khan showed his street power in Islamabad, and in response to government's rally, opposition parties last night also gathered on the main highway in the capital, Islamabad, where opposition leaders made fiery speeches and were confident that their move to remove Prime Minister Imran Khan through a vote of no confidence will succeed. As far as the vote of no confidence is concerned, the formal process was kicked off yesterday. Now the session of the National Assembly, the lower house of Pakistan's parliament, will meet again on Thursday when the debate will start on the vote of no confidence. As per the Pakistani constitution, once the resolution is tabled inside the National Assembly, the voting has to take place within 7 days. So we expect that by early next week, the voting will take place, and we will have the answer whether Prime Minister Imran Khan will survive.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Iran welcomes Yemen's new peace initiative to end the Saudi-led war. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says the proposed plan shows the determination of Sana'a to bring to an end the war and blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia through political means. He hoped that by giving priority to humanitarian issues and promoting the exchange of prisoners, the crisis would be resolved. Sana'a has announced a unilateral ceasefire, saying it is ready for a permanent truce if Riyadh withdraws its forces, halts supporting local militia, and ends its siege. Since March 2015, the war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, either directly or indirectly. The UN says the war and blockade have made Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Now, to discuss that further, we are joined by Saeed Shahabi, activist and political analyst out of London, and also Saeed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, also from London. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. Let's begin with Mr. Shahabi. Well, we heard the leader of the Houthis saying that he hopes that Saudi Arabia would take advantage of this ceasefire in order to reach some kind of consensus and end the war. How likely do you think is Saudi Arabia to take that seriously and take some steps in that direction?
Thank you very much. It is clear that the Saudis have put themselves in a hole from which they cannot get out easily. The Yemenis are now proposing that Ramadan is coming. Let us have some truce for a few days. Let us start by exchanging some prisoners and allowing some food into the country, removing the blockade. But of course, none of these conditions are acceptable to the Saudis, who see that their chances of winning the war are floundering. There's no chance that they will make a comeback in the war, and they have just been defeated morally, politically, and there is no way out of it. It is, of course, the duty of the world to come and put pressure on the Saudis. Unfortunately, the Saudis are still supported by the Western powers, who are taking double standards by standing against Russia in the war on Ukraine, while standing with Saudi Arabia in its war against Yemen. So there is a crisis of morality, of ethics, of behavior in the world, but at the same time, there is determination among the Yemenis to pursue their defense of their country until the Saudis give up and forced out of their land. Ramadan is coming. It is everybody's hope that the war will come to an end and that the world will stand by the victims and against the aggressors. Unfortunately, this is not happening, but the Yemenis are capable of defending themselves.
Well, thank you very much. Mr. Mohsen Abbas, now, in your opinion, what would be the next step if Saudi Arabia does not take this opportunity, this ceasefire opportunity, to end the war? What could the Houthis do? What are they capable of?
Well, the game changer in this war has been really the air power of the Ansarullah. And whilst at the beginning of the war, they were fighting very much as a guerrilla force, very unique tactics that they were using, and even then, very successfully, they were taking on the invasion forces, because that's where they are. The Saudi forces are invading a foreign land which has nothing to do with them in terms of interference. But when the drone technology arrived within the Ansarullah's kind of military, if you like, knowledge, when the missiles were developed, because of course the Ansarullah and the Yemeni army had abilities with missiles, and they had abilities on a technical level long before even the latest wave. But the truth is that now the level of technology that's emerging The writing's on the wall. The Saudis are really facing a situation of being between the rock and a hard place, really. They've got no choice. The Ansarullah have been attacking wave upon wave now in terms of hitting targets like the Al Shugayt water desalination plant, the oil facility of Aramco in Jizan, Dahran power plant has been hit, Khamis Mosheikh gas facility has been hit, and the Aramco's gas liquidation factory in Yanbu. This is just since the 19th of March. So you can see that the Ansarullah have given them a lesson to say, look, you've been bombing us to the point of obliteration, 377,000 deaths. 60% of those are due to hunger and healthcare, mind you, which was again because the Saudis were targeting water facilities and damaging the basic infrastructure of Yemen, not necessarily fighting the soldiers. 2.5 million cholera cases directly related to this war, with over 4,000 deaths up to since 2016, as far as my research goes. And famine conditions, you know, even the UN says 19 million people will go hungry this year, and 160,000 are literally in famine conditions. This is the result of the Saudi war of terror, really, on the civilian population of Yemen. I think this is the saddest aspect of what the Saudis have done. It's criminal enough that they've gone to try and seize the sovereignty of another nation. But it's even worse that they've actually used the civilians as a means of trying to subjugate the Yemeni opposition that's up against them. But where will it go? The Saudis are finished in terms of a military solution. They've got parity. The Yemeni Ansarullah have parity with the Saudis in terms of being able to hit targets. And so the only thing really left, the only logical, sensible thing for the Saudis would be to sit at the table as is being proposed, to withdraw their forces, stop their support of the local militias there, and to end these sieges and to come to a reasonable settlement and let the regional issues be dealt by regional powers themselves. Perhaps the other regional forces in the area can get involved. As far as the role that the Saudis are facilitating, which is the interests of the Americans and the Anglo-Zionist Empire, well, you know, this is what the Saudis have been doing for far too long, and they really need to see that that's a receding power, and their long-run interest is with their neighbors, and that's where they should go, is to go towards peace now.
Thank you very much, our guest from London, Saeed Shahabi, activist and political analyst, and also Saeed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts with us on this edition of the News Review. And thanks to all of you for following us.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
There's trouble in London's police service at New Scotland Yard. They state our vision for the Met is to be the most trusted police service in the world. We contribute to making London the safest global city. We protect its unique reputation as an open and welcoming city. And we want Londoners to be proud of their police. However, a series of damaging cases involving people who have served as London police officers may have undermined the credibility of the Met's ability to sustain the confidence and trust of the general public.
In late 2021, two UK police officers pleaded guilty to sharing photos of the bodies of two murdered sisters at a crime scene they were assigned to protect. In court, officers Dennis Jaffa and Jamie Lewis admitted sharing the images.
Are you going to apologise for what you did?
Today they admitted misconduct in a public office and were warned they faced lengthy prison.
Other officers have been accused of abandoning an alleged domestic abuse victim in a flat shared with her potentially violent partner, with police allegedly telling her, "There is nothing we can do." Worse still, former police officer Wayne Cousins was convicted of abducting Sarah Everard in a London street as she walked home, then raping and murdering her in a case that has shocked Britain. Her body was found in woodland 80 kilometres away in southeast England. The Everard case has stirred protests over violence against women by the police. The impact of these convictions involving officers has been felt inside and outside the police service. The Metropolitan Police Force, which investigated the murder by Cousins, said it was sickened, angered and devastated by his crimes. Commissioner Cressida Dick apologised, while Labour Party politician Harriet Harman called on Dick to resign, adding, "Women must be able to trust the police, not fear them. Women's confidence in police will have been shattered." Even Prime Minister Boris Johnson added, "Our police are there to protect us, and I know that officers will share in our shock and devastation at the total betrayal of this duty."
How can people who have committed criminal acts of violence pass the recruitment process for a police force? What impact have recent convictions of police officers in London for serious law-breaking offences had on public confidence in the law enforcement services? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. What, in terms of the public's view, constitutes a reasonable standard of behaviour for police officers? We put that to the public here in central London. This is what they told us.
Generally, what do you expect in terms of standards of behaviour from any police force? What do you want the police, how do you want them to behave?
I want them to be supportive, but not like judge people based on obviously looks or gender or anything like that. I don't want them to be scary. I don't want to be like they're facing towards me and I become scared of them.
Well, one would hope for high standards, but just lately, probably not.
At least 50% better than they are at the moment.
Yes.
But they have a hard time. And they've got so many things that they're controlled to do, like racial things, abuse of people.
Just to meet the basic, like the citizen needs, like if they need any help with directions, or if you see that they're like in trouble, just to assist, just to help out. If you see someone stealing, but they're stealing, like, diapers type of thing, then you just, like, help out, I guess. That's a policeman's job anywhere around the world, I feel like.
Yes.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
you know, not behave in the way that we've seen recently in the news, in terms of we want to be able to trust them and feel that we're in safe hands.
Yes.
So there needs to be a very strong code of conduct, and if people don't follow that code of conduct, then they need to go. The job's not right for them.
Just like security, like if you ever, like, you know, if something ever happened, that you could phone them and they would be there quite quickly.
For them to treat everyone equally, not to treat people different, look different than others. I'd expect them to be polite to the public, to look. I think you want to see a police officer and feel that they're safe to approach, and you know.
I think throughout COVID, it's probably changed a little bit. Less aggressive, to be honest, what I've seen on the news. I know they've got a hard job to do, but I think on the news lately they haven't been portrayed very well.
And the tourists, they don't know particularly about the people that they can take away their bags or their phones, like me, that I hand my phone. So I expect to protect those people and do not leave it like this, like, okay, just leave it happen. It's something that can happen every day.
Good discipline, really. Around, obviously, a lot of presence.
I think just being available for the public when they need them.
Well, I expect them to be respectful and to consider the needs of the people that they're protecting.
I think they should be courteous. They should be there and available for you to speak to.
Two police officers admitted sharing photos of two murdered women in London on a social network. How does the public feel about their actions?
Yeah, that's a different kind of situation there, too, obviously. I mean, as you say, when a police officer, you obviously want your 100% faith in themselves, you trust them, don't you, really? And stuff like that, is obviously, there's no excuse, there's no flares there, really. You can't excuse that at all.
I think it's horrendous. And what's probably worse is they shared it and other people looked at them and presumably quite enjoyed them, and it's awful.
I think they should get fired. That's definitely confidential, so they shouldn't be sharing that. Yeah.
That's disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. Now, I work for the NHS, and we see some difficult things at work, and it's gross misconduct if you share any information about your patients or any images, and I would expect the police to behave in exactly the same way. And to have a WhatsApp group, it's just terrible.
You wouldn't expect that from police officers. They're meant to be there to, keep you safe. So that just really angers me whenever I hear that,
At first I've heard of it, but it obviously sounds wrong.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you just inherently think that's wrong just as a person, not a policeman or otherwise. Just as a human, you wouldn't do that, would you?
At the scene of a crime, that's terrible. I don't think any private thing should be taken or shared. It's police material, should not be shared with the public.
I think that's very, very, very bad and very unrespectful towards the woman, but also like the family towards this woman.
I think that's definitely sort of part over the line as such. Definitely not professional and shouldn't happen, really.
I don't know the details of that particular incident, but if that was done without consideration of their privacy or was not part of some kind of formal release of investigation, then I think there's probably some wrongdoing there.
I think it's a boundary that has been crossed. I don't think that's the right thing to do.
Just not having any clue of the feelings of the families or all people. Like, you're dealing with this traumatic event, and you just don't have the compassion to understand how traumatic this is for everyone. If you're taking photos and being a tourist about it, we're kind of losing the point of being a person.
Social media is probably 90% of the problem. And I think anybody that uses that platform to accentuate any crime or reveal and share is rather disturbed, to be honest.
A London police officer has been jailed for life for raping and murdering a woman called Sarah Everard. How is it that a murderer was able to serve in the police? Here's the public's opinion.
Perhaps, there needs to be tightened regulations or a reevaluation of how, we select the police. Or
they should obviously have to go up against a platform of where there's some kind of, you know, control or procedure that's put in place like it was in the old days in the United Kingdom?
I guess, like, you never know who the bad guy is until something happens.
It got through the loophole somehow because, you know, usually... I presume they do checks on something's work picked up, so something's gone wrong there. I mean, there are bad people in all walks of society.
Maybe they just didn't do enough background checks on him before he went into the police force. Maybe they need to get more, like, tighter on security checks on who's going into the police.
You mean, well, how would anyone know that someone is going to do that, right? And you can only run a criminal background check on someone if they've been convicted of a crime. So if they've been suspected and weren't indicted on it, you know, like, weren't convicted of it, then there's no record of it.
I wonder the same thing. But then also rapists and murders are also a bit everywhere. It's just sad that they are also in the police force because you think, like, if I want to be police, I'm a good person and should follow the law. And also leads to more, like, scariness because why should I trust the police if they also murder me? And like that.
Yeah, how do they? I wouldn't be best to answer that. I'm sure they get vetted before they start the role, but, yeah, it's not nice. But it could happen in any profession, I suppose. But, yeah, again, it's... you'd expect it not to happen in the police, but these things do happen, unfortunately.
Well, there's obviously a lot of police personnel, so anyone can get in, really. Again, it's down to the individual. I wouldn't say that's them as a whole, and to say it is them as a whole is completely wrong, in my opinion.
It's a very sad news, and I think it puts the entire police on a very bad spot.
Well, I don't think, say, mental illness or those type of issues... they have no bounds. It doesn't matter what your career is or how intelligent you are.
I should think the vetting process needs to be more studied and more thorough when they either at recruiting stage or progressively through their life.
Here are the facts. The London Metropolitan Police employs almost 33,000 officers in the front line to try and keep law and order in a city with a population of around 10 million people. Yet, since 2005, 26 Met officers were convicted of sex crimes, 27 of theft, and 72 were convicted of violence against other people. Has public confidence been affected by these latest convictions? A poll in October 2021 revealed 63% of those polled trusted the police in general, but only 33% trusted the Metropolitan Police. In the same poll, 31% said they did not trust the police in general, but that lack of trust rises to 43% for the London Metropolitan Police, meaning that more people distrust the London Met than trust them.
Given all these recent revelations, what level of trust do the people here in London feel able to give their police force?
Ooh, that's a loaded question.
would you make a call and feel safe, or?
I would make a call. Yeah, I mean, because at the end of the day, you still have to trust that the government is working.
You would go to them, but not perhaps one on his own.
Yes.
You'd want two.
Difficult to say, because I think the Londoners have come to accept it. Visitors, depending on where they come from, might find it strange to have that sort of police force in somewhere like civilised world like the UK.
I think anywhere in the world that stuff happens. Like, the police and the government's corrupt anywhere.
It's an isolated incident, and I would say 99.9% of police officers are doing the job for the right reason. You can't tar them all with the same brush.
I do still trust the police because that was one person, but, yeah, it's just... It makes it quite difficult, you know, to trust them after hearing that.
How many policemen are there in London, policemen or women? I'd say this is a very, very small minority, surely, of the force as a whole, in which case I'd be likely to trust them.
not really so much trust. Because like when I see them or like when they're around the area, I want to feel like, okay, safe, they're here. But if I know that they also do this and that it happens often, of course I don't feel safe around them.
To be honest, not very much. Unfortunately, I have here 2 years, and to be honest, I don't have seen much effort from the police to do their best to protect their people, the residents here.
Just because, you know, that's what you see in the news and the papers, so that's the sort of front face of the police, is the negative stuff. I do think the police do a lot of positive as well that doesn't necessarily get reported on.
Well, the fact that if it's been confirmed that someone like that has been serving in our police, and particularly if it's been known for a while and action hasn't been taken, then it reduces our trust.
There's a lot of crime in the police force happening, so I think it's hard to say 100% yes.
Well, I guess you do somewhat not. It does reduce your trust.
You know, you have these kind of incidents all over the world, and I don't think London policing or the police force in the United Kingdom should be held to blame for an incident like that.
Well, that's not fair to lump all the police together, so I think there's still trust in the London police.
Looking at the situation from an international perspective, what image does this police behaviour generate to the wider world about the way law and order is carried out in the capital of the United Kingdom?
I guess you just got to be cautious. It scares people, like, not to be able to trust the police officers.
I mean, I've come to London this weekend, you know, these few days to visit, and I was walking around late last night. I probably feel safer here than I do in my own home, if I'm honest, because there's lots of people around, and you know, it feels busy and it's well lit.
It did make me quite scared because I lived in London during the pandemic and I heard about that girl getting murdered. So it just makes you think, like, is this good? Is the security here good, you know, in London? And, like, as a girl, do you feel safe walking home at night when you're hearing that? Yeah. So I'd say it just does scare you a bit. Yeah.
Those examples obviously aren't good, but in general, I'd surely say that the police are doing a good job.
I think it scares everybody, really. And, I mean, as a tourist myself, I don't really feel so safe walking around here when the police is doing this.
I don't think we should be preaching to internationally to any country, to be honest. We should look closer to home first before we start preaching out, should I say, so to speak. Yeah.
Well, information now travels very, very fast nowadays, and you know, immediately everybody will know in the other countries, so, and everybody talks about it, and for sure it can it does damage to the image of the police here in Great Britain. Absolutely.
I definitely think it'll have a negative effect. You know, it's sort of the first impressions, isn't it? If that's sort of the first you hear about British police or English police, and it's a negative story, then that sets it up for the future. And
I think it projects an image that this not being correctly managed at the highest levels, and more needs to be done. And I imagine that other nations looking in would wonder, well, if you're allowing that to happen, what else are you allowing to happen too? And therefore breeding greater distrust overall, not only for our own police services, but perhaps breeding mistrust in other aspects of our public services.
I think that it's really sad, and it puts a bad image on the London police.
I think it is a real eye-opener.
It is definitely going to affect, because the people coming from other countries are definitely going to think wrongly.
Whether they break the law themselves, they need to be reprimanded, or whether they're carrying out the law, they need to serve and protect with the utmost integrity and respect for the public as well, because that is their vow and the pledge that they take.
A catalogue of offences uncovered by investigations and confirmed in court has served to keep London's police force in the media for all the wrong reasons. While the UK has previously criticised other countries for their failures in law and order, London's own police force appears a case study in offences admittedly by a small number of individuals, but nevertheless, these cases have undermined the credibility of the force. And some would say it's authority to preach to other countries about enforcement standards.
Revelations and court cases against members of the London Police have damaged confidence in the force. These have also raised questions about the public's level of trust in the police in London. Now, most police do an excellent, honest and difficult job. However, public opinion suggests that trust, which takes a long time to build, can be quickly lost. It is a substantial challenge for the Metropolitan Police to win back what it has lost in terms of that public confidence and, some would say, its international reputation due to the illegal actions of an irresponsible, violent and even murdering few members of the force.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. And welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program for humanity. We are looking at human justice. And we are looking at human justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi as-salam. We were looking at a letter written by the commander of the faithful himself, given to one of his disciples, one of his commanders, Malik al-Ashtar, where if we examine that letter itself, we get to see that the true essence of justice, the true essence of human rights, are included in this letter. Now, we don't have time to examine the entire letter. Rather, we will take some parts of it and we can see how we can apply it to our modern day and how justice was applied in the sight of Amir al-Mu'mineen compared to the countries and the systems that we live under today. One of the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen mentions in this letter is a collection of revenue. Now, obviously, any country will not exist from the economy aspect unless it has sources of revenue, whether it is agriculture or oil or gold or coal or gas. They must have a source where they have to cultivate and generate a source of income. Now, that is important that a country should use their resources and find means to create revenue, because obviously there are people, the rights of other people depends on it. So, for example, we see Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he talks to Malik al-Ashtar, he says to him, you have to ensure the prosperity of those who pay the revenue to the state. And that's extremely important. Why? Because the farmers, for example, or businessmen, or those who are traders, now, those are the ones that create revenue for the country. It's the job of the government, the job of the system, to take care of those people. As long as those businessmen, those farmers, those tradesmen are actively working, then they will give back in taxes or in khums or sadaqah or charity or zakah. At the end of the day, they will give back revenue to the government, which in return the government gives to the poor people. If those people, the tradesmen and the farmers and what have you, if they are themselves deprived, then what happens is the people and the masses will be deprived. So Amir al-Mu'mineen is saying to him, take care of those people. Make sure they are prosperous. Make sure they're happy. Make sure that their needs is set. Why? Because on their prosperity depends the prosperity of others, and particularly the masses themselves. Indeed, in the state exists on its revenue. The state itself, it's only existing because of the revenue that it makes. Now, we will continue this, but first, let us take a short break.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we were saying that revenue is extremely important for the government and for the state. And this revenue, there are those who generate it. And those who generate those revenues or those revenues, they need to be taken care of because on them, many people are depending. So this was the advice of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam to Malik al-Ashtar. And then Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi highlights an important factor. He says, you should regard the proper upkeep of the land and cultivation as of a greater importance than the collection of revenue. Now, this is obviously Amir al-Mu'mineen. He's taking one dimension of revenue because obviously back in the day, the main revenue was from cultivating the lands and farms. Now we have oils and gas and minerals and mines and what have you. So when you look at farming, for example, and obviously the life of people depends on farming because we need the wheat and flour, we need the fruits and vegetables and what have you. This is what we live on. We don't live on biscuits and sweets, do we? So Amir al-Mu'mineen says, what's more important than collecting the revenue is that you have to make sure that the land is, people can cultivate the land and they have the means to cultivate it. Because if the land itself is not cultivated, then there will be nothing grown, no crops will grow. If no crops will grow, there will be no revenue to make. The land will not produce anything. For revenue, he says, cannot be derived except by making the land productive. If the land itself is not productive, then it's not going to give you anything. And this is something that we see in a lot of countries that they don't pay attention to. When other countries, for example, want to export their own products to another country, if they have an influence on that country, they make sure that the lands are not cultivated. They make sure that the lands do not get the right means. For example, if we look at Africa, America and the West want to sell their products, whether it's wheat, flour, or rice, to those countries. In order for them to sell their products, they have to make sure that their lands don't get cultivated. There is no revenue in the land itself. Otherwise, there will be no need for them. So you can see that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi is saying that should not happen. In your own state, the main focus should be on revenue that you make yourself. That you need to go back to your land and cultivate the land. Now, you can cultivate the land by either growing on it, by digging mines and getting gold and silver and iron and whatever minerals are required. Or you can even cultivate it when it comes to oil. Do your own work. Through this kind of method of cultivating one's land, then I could ensure the prosperity and the happiness of my people and the happiness of the masses. Otherwise, we're going to have a lot of poverty, we're going to have a lot of ignorance, and everything will fall apart. So from here, he's saying to Malik, make sure that your land is cultivated, those who cultivate the land are being taken care of, and also that you need to create revenue in order for you to help and support the masses. We'll leave it up to here, and inshallah, we will continue in the episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. اللهم صل على محمد وآله.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.